Hello, welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, students at Mount Allison University in New Brunswick will have to swallow a 3% hike in tuition fees in 23-24. The university says revenues don't match expenses.
Any increase will impact a student's ability to attend university, whether that big or small. Quality education is important, and we don't feel as though people's financial situation should impact people's ability to get a job and fulfill their goals and aspirations.
A New Brunswick resident is fighting against illegal dumps on private and public land in the Tantramar.
We have more education on the environment, and we should be doing everything we can to clean it up. It's such a beautiful area that I'd hate to see a huge devastation at something that we know is here and we can do something about. At this point, it becomes our responsibility.
Forest fires are being contained in Nova Scotia. Some residents are getting ready to reintegrate their homes, but fires are still burning strong in Quebec. And to Oshawa, Ontario, where a local craftswoman is sharing her moccasin making knowledge with the next generation.
I want to be able to teach people how to make it so we can carry it on. They can, you know, maybe teach their kids and their grandkids how to do it so we don't lose it.
This and a bit more on Viewpoints.
Local news nationwide.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Welcome. Nice to have you with us. So bad news for students in New Brunswick who will have to dig deeper into their pockets as soon as next September. They will have to swallow a 3% hike in tuition fees in 2023-2024. Sackville's Mount Allison University says it does not have any other choice as costs are rising faster than revenues. The increases bring overall tuition to more than $10,000 annually for domestic students, following a $290 increase, and to more than $20,200 annually for international students, with a $590 tuition hike. In addition to the general increases in tuition fees, there are separate increases for new aviation students and also for residence fees and meal plans. Altogether, the university will have a $2 million operational deficit. Here's David Gordon Kosh.
The Mount Allison Students Union, or MASU, released a statement on the budget last week. It acknowledged some key budgetary requests were addressed, notably at $100,000 for physical accessibility projects on campus, but said the student union is deeply disappointed with the tuition hike. MASU also stated that residence fees will increase anywhere from $200 to $1,000, depending on room type. For more on this issue, CHMA spoke to MASU President Olivia Warr and Bailey Andrews, who is the student union's VP Communications and Marketing.
We represent approximately 2,300 students, and I think the general effect on students will be any increase will impact a student's ability to attend university, whether that big or small. And this increase, while expected, in some aspects will impact students' financial accessibility to university.
Is the solution more government funding, or does MASU have a position on how the government should finance these things or ensure accessibility to university for students?
Well, our ultimate goal is to have ongoing relationships with the university, the provincial and the federal governments to work towards solutions that address the needs of students financially. We don't have a political stance on this. We just want to work with all parties who can impact accessibility and affordability of students' education.
Do you think free tuition should be the goal? There's been demands from groups in the Quebec student movement, for example, over the years, and it's been implemented in a number of countries around the world.
I would say that the answer to that question is largely dependent on individual people. I'm not sure that we could comment as the MASU stance as a student union in terms of free tuition. But obviously our goal as a student union that advocates for the students is going to be education that's most accessible and affordable for all students, because quality education is important and we don't feel as though people's financial situation should impact people's ability to get a job and fulfill their goals and aspirations.
The university's operating budget is based on a 2% increase in a grant from the provincial government. That covers 44% of operating revenue. Another 50% of the university's revenue comes from tuition and student fees. Altogether, the university will have a $2 million operational deficit for the coming fiscal year. Mount Allison has faced a deficit annually for 4 years in a row, according to Robert Engels, VP of Finance and Administration for the university.
We're able to do this for a reasonably short period of time because the cash coming in and out of the university is always sufficient and should be sufficient the next few years to always meet all the things that we have to spend our money on. So no, we've not had to go to the bank, for example, to finance the deficit over the last few years.
Because of the specifics of the way cash flow at Mount Allison operates, Mount Allison isn't actually going into debt to finance it.
We're not borrowing from the bank.
Not yet. And so why over the past 4 years have you resorted to a deficit, an operating deficit? Why now?
Well, it is because one thing is we had to deal with the pandemic, right? And so that was two of the 4 years easy. We received no support, external support, unlike some other jurisdictions, to deal with costs of the pandemic, which were, I don't have it handy, but it was between $1 to $2 million, perhaps even $2 million. Then the other years that were at the costs that were not pandemic related, it's really a view about recognizing what it takes to support a small university with all the things that we're doing. So we've put resources into a whole host of areas over the last years. So we have put resources into sexual violence, into counseling, into marketing, for example, in an effort to increase enrollment. You got to spend the money first to recruit the students, whether it's program development, marketing, communications, recruiting, all those things take efforts, and you have to hire the people, spend the resources, develop the programs, and then ideally that needs to turn into more students.
The provincial government has said that universities will receive another 1.5% increase in their operating grant if they manage to increase enrollment by 2%. Engels said that for the purposes of this year's budget, enrollment remains essentially flat at Mount Allison. 700 new students are expected in the fall. Last year, 750 were expected, but only 690 showed up. New Brunswick has witnessed a large-scale decline in post-secondary enrollment over the past 20 years, the only province in the country facing that situation, according to Higher Education Strategy Associates, a Toronto-based consulting firm. Another feature of post-secondary education in New Brunswick is the high level of debt that students tend to hold when they graduate. Students who graduate with a bachelor's degree in New Brunswick end their studies with an average of $40,000 in debt, the second highest rate in the country after Nova Scotia, according to 2015 data from Statistics Canada. The Federation of New Brunswick Faculty Associations has attributed rising tuition and heavy debt loads to a gradual reduction of provincial government funding for universities, at least in terms of the share of costs actually shouldered by the province. Here's Jean Sauvageau, past president of the Federation of New Brunswick Faculty Associations, speaking before a legislative committee in February. He addressed the committee in French with live interpretation in English provided by the Legislative Assembly.
And in the case of New Brunswick, in 1979-1980, the government funded public universities at a rate of 82% of their operational costs. And in 2019-2020, with the latest data that are available to us, this rate is 56% for the share of universities' operational costs that are funded by the provincial government. So there's been an erosion of public funding on the part of governments.
CHMA asked Robert Engels, the Mount A administrator, about the gradual erosion of government funding since the 1980s that Sauvageau described. Engels said that what happened in the 80s is ancient history and that he's looking to the future.
The head of the Mount Allison Faculty Association didn't respond to a request for comment by publication time.
Hello, I'm Andrew Dow in Six Nations, Ontario. You are tuned in to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
The The enormous fire at Barrington Lake in Shelburne, Nova Scotia is slowly coming under control, and efforts are beginning to shift from emergency response to community rebuilding. The Shelburne County East Emergency Management Office reported Tuesday that the fire is still out of control, but is now being held, which means it's not moving. Several measures have been announced to help residents transition back into their homes or to help those whose homes were lost in the fire. The federal and provincial governments have announced they will match every dollar donated to the Red Cross so that any dollar donated equals $3. More on this with Ed Alverson.
The province of Nova Scotia is providing free well water testing kits for people returning home and has just announced a one-time grant of $2,500 to registered farmers located in the mandatory evacuation zones in Halifax Regional Municipality and Shelburne County. The province has previously announced $500 per household in emergency funding, and $2,500 will be made available to small businesses. Life is returning to normal for some students, as several schools in the Shelburne and Barrington area reopened Thursday. Classes are back on at Clark's Harbour Elementary, Evelyn Richardson Memorial School, and the Lockport Schools. No decision has been made on when staff and students at Barrington Municipal High School, Forest Ridge Academy, Hillcrest Academy, and Shelburne Regional High School will return to class. The Shelburne County fire covers 23,411 hectares, or 234 square kilometers. Roughly 130 firefighters from the Department of Natural Resources and Renewables and more than 40 volunteer and municipal firefighters are responding. Restrictions on travel and activities in the woods were lifted across Nova Scotia but remain in Shelburne County and anywhere evacuation orders are in place. A province-wide ban on fires with fines up to $25,000 remains in effect as well. The section of Highway 103 in Shelburne County that was closed to non-emergency traffic because of the wildfires is being reopened in phases. Commercial traffic and healthcare workers can travel the highway overnight between 8 p.m. and 6 a.m. Vehicles will be escorted to ensure driver safety and compliance, and officials are advising to prepare for delays of an hour or more. The highway will remain closed during the day to allow emergency vehicles to travel freely. Government released a statement Friday to say they're not planning any further media briefings on the wildfires at this time. I'm Ed Halverson.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
And we're now following up on Erica Butler's invitation for a kind of sound walk, we should say, with the Tatramar resident Kerry Simpson. Simpson has been calling for the cleanup of dump sites in the newly expanded municipality of Tatramar, the amalgamation of the former town of Sackville and the village of Dorchester and close by areas. When Tatramar Council started discussing its new dangerous and unsightly premises bylaw, which it passed last May, Simpson was paying attention. She has long been bothered by a number of sites in the new municipality where she hikes and walks with her daughter's dog, sites that feature loads of garbage or discarded items. Often, these sites are on private land, and Simpson wonders how, if ever, they will get cleaned up. Journalist Erica Butler visits such sites with Simpson just off Cape Road outside of Dorchester, where thousands of tires have been strewn throughout the woods and overgrown with brush.
Like, there's that huge pile right there.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, when I said that there was, like, it doesn't look like a lot, but when you start counting them one by one, like, there's thousands. There's got to be. Did someone pass away and there's just, it doesn't belong to anyone now? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But what happens when, if that happens? Yeah. Is it going to be the province that cleans it up? Is it going to be the town of Tatramar that cleans it up? Or is it just sit here for another 20, 30, 40 years? I don't know what kind of damage tires do to the earth, but that's what it looks like the whole way down. Just little mounds of tires. And this gets fairly dry, so I just worry that one day you're going to have a lightning storm, you're going to have just a piece of glass that hits the sun the wrong way, and there it goes. Mm. It's gone.
So, yeah, the fire concern is a big one, and also just whatever other kind of environmental impact.
Environmental impact. There is a beaver dam just right down, I believe, at the bottom of this hill, and I just wonder what kind of impact that has on them or anything, moose, deer.
you know, we started talking a bit about like possible solutions. You're not sure. Is it going to be the province? Is it going to be the municipality? I mean, do you have an ideal version of how this would be addressed?
It depends on the situation. We have to do our research, and we could look at it as a case by case basis. So if there is mental illness behind it, what have you, then of course that needs more of a community effort than an enforcement. And if it's just someone blatantly refuses to pick it up, then that to me is an enforcement, to force them to pick it up or suffer the fines. Mm-hmm. But I'm all for working with people as well.
When dump sites like the one Carrie Simpson discovered are left to fester, it's bad news for the environment, says Sam Rogers, habitat restoration and monitoring worker with Fort Folly Habitat Recovery. Rogers has been helping organize dump site cleanups with funding from the province's Environmental Trust Fund. In the past 2 years, Fort Folly Habitat Recovery has collected 15 tons of garbage from roughly 15 different sites, and they will be back at it again this year. Rogers says things like tires can cause problems for nearby waterways and wildlife.
While it takes a long time for these to break down, they do, and they release the chemicals that they're comprised of into the soil and again into the water, and they just create a concoction of problems. A lot of the time we find appliances and many things that they do leak chemicals, and we've seen leakages as well. Like, we've come across what looks like oil changes or other things, and people just leave the bottles out to release chemicals wherever they are into the environment.
Some of the sites that Rogers and the Fort Folly team have helped clean up are historical dumps, like the tire graveyard Simpson found. But some are also still active, with people, for some reason, choosing to dispose of their detritus in the woods.
I would say a lot of the sites we come across are, I hate to say it, maybe laziness. It's a lot of household garbage, sometimes even bagged, that's just left in the ditches, and they've been torn into by wildlife or children's toys. Or like a few times it's obvious that there was construction that had happened and someone had dumped like their old boards and nails and shingles or whatever else. And there's also been times we've seen closer to the First Nation, maybe sites that were used to dump university dorm room supplies, where you can see that there's books and snacks and other items that would be indicative of that.
Rogers says she's not sure whether the 15 sites that she and Fort Folly Habitat Recovery have cleaned up are the tip of the iceberg or not.
It's hard to say if you make a dent. I know, like, we clean up a lot and we get tons of waste that come out of those areas, but then you return next year and there's more. And there are even signs in those areas for no dumping, and I know that they are patrolled to a degree, but it's such a large problem and there's so many ways around it that it remains an issue within communities that is difficult to address if you don't have the resources.
Fort Folly Habitat Recovery and other organizations like the Petit Kodiak Watershed Alliance have been funding cleanups through small grants from the province's Environmental Trust Fund. One new project funded this year from the same fund could help paint a picture of just how big the problem is. Eco360, the service of the Southeast Regional Service Commission responsible for disposing of all the waste collected in the Southeast, has received a $30,000 grant to put towards helping communities identify and clean up illegal dump sites. Director Sebastian Holtberg says the first phase of the project is to expand the Eco360 app to allow for people like Carrie Simpson to easily report dump sites.
What we hope is that you'll be able to snap a photo, get the coordinates, and it will all happen automatically, and we will build the database. So that's the first portion of this project. And once we have the data of where these dump sites that better exist, then we can look at how we can help.
Holtberg says Eco360 already has one service in place to help communities tackle dump sites, the Eco360 cleanup trailer.
It's a trailer that community groups can sort of lease for free. We supply it, and in this trailer there's all the tools and protective equipment that you would need, and the supplies to help clean up one of these sites. So that's something that we already have and that we're looking at sort of tackling or joining with this project. And then, of course, there's also, we will be working with the Department of Environment and local government on this to help share the data that we get with them so that they get a better picture of what it looks like as well.
Most of the dump sites identified and cleaned up by Fort Folly Habitat Recovery are on public land. Dumping grounds on private land add an extra layer of difficulty in that there's the permission of the property owner to be had and also their potential responsibility in the matter. Kerry Simpson thinks the new town of Tantramar can play a role in helping facilitate the cleanup of new and historic dump sites across the new municipality, even if they are on private land. Her plea to councillors at their May meeting, just before they approved the town's new dangerous and unsightly premises bylaw, was use it.
We write these bylaws for the people who are going to follow them. And we hope that the other 10% or the other 5% fall in line. I think we need to start looking after the 10 and the 5% instead of relying on the 90% that follow them and start writing these bylaws for everybody. But what do we do when people don't follow it? We say that we don't have enough bylaw officers or we don't have enough employees. Well, then if you can't support the bylaw, then don't write it.
Ultimately, Simpson thinks that enforcement needs to be accompanied by possible support for facilitating cleanups.
And I appreciate the fact that it probably started years ago and when we weren't so concerned about the environment, but now we know we have more education on the environment and we should be doing everything we can to clean it up and ensure that our trees and our land and our animals are going to be here, you know, 20 years from now. It's such a beautiful area that I'd hate to see a huge devastation at something that we know is here and so we can do something about. So at this point, it becomes our responsibility.
That's Tantramar resident Kerry Simpson.
And she was speaking with Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. Local crafter Janine Jameson saw her virtual mocassin making workshops take off during the COVID-19 pandemic. Jameson hopes she'll be able to carry on the teachings to the next generation. She plans to host another mocassin workshop in June in conjunction with Chiefswood Park, a cultural heritage destination that offers a variety of product experiences aiming to teach guests about authentic Haudenosaunee culture. Journalist Andrew Dow is in Oshawa, Ontario. He had a chat with Janine Jameson.
So thank you very much for joining me this morning, Janine.
Thank you, Andy.
So firstly, I was wondering how you got into moccasin making. It's definitely a very cool skill. Has this been something that you've done your whole life or something that's been picked up along the way?
Yeah, it's something I've done my whole life. I was taught by my grandmother, Hannah General, when I was very young. Our grandmother lived with us and she always did crafts, beadwork, moccasins. She did mostly baby moccasins. And that's how I learned how to do moccasins. And then through COVID, I picked up my crafts again and I had a refresher in moccasins by my friend. And I just got back into it.
How has it been being able to offer these online or in virtual courses in that format compared to offering them in person?
Well, it was so different having to do a lot more things online through COVID, right? There was like absolutely everything you had to do online. We all jumped on the computer and watched this virtual lesson of the beaded corn keychain. So it's like, well, why can't we do that with other things as well? So like, that's how I took off with my moccasin workshop. In the very beginning of COVID, like I really wasn't expecting my workshop to take off like it did. So I hosted one and like within minutes it filled up. I had 20 people in the workshop. So I was like, my God, now I got to make all these kits. How am I going to do this? So I filled up the one and then there were still people asking. And then I ended up filling another one of 20 more people within a span of like 2 hours. Like it totally blew up.
I was just wondering if you could break down what the participants were able to learn from the workshop and just how everything went with it.
I provide a double sole moccasin. And once the participant first learns how to sew on the sole with sinew then once the sole is sewed on, we apply a fleece lining. And then once that is done, then we start to sew on the vamp. And then the vamp is where they can learn how to do the puckering. But it's fairly easy. Everybody can learn how to do it, right? It just takes, you know, just take your time and learn how to sew it. And everybody is so happy at the end when they're done. Not hard.
And you talked about how you learned from your grandmother. Can you talk about the importance that moccasins serve here to Six Nations? Obviously, it's a traditional form of footwear. And I think it's always cool to hear about the special designs that each pair can have. So do you think that being able to provide services like this is important in being able to hold on to the traditional values and even educating the younger generations about those?
Oh, yeah, of course, because it's like, you know, how our people were sent off to residential schools. You know, we lost our language and lost our cultures there. So, you know, me being able to provide and teach people how to make moccasins, you know, we're carrying on that tradition so we don't lose it. And then, yes, everybody's moccasins are different. There's like not two pair that are alike, right? Because everybody's going to design different. They're going to have, they might put beadwork on it and it'll look different than somebody else's design. So it's nice that way because you can make your own unique pair of moccasins.
In saying that, how has the feedback been? I'm assuming most people are pretty happy to get into this course. And then obviously they're leaving with a brand new pair of moccasins as well. So can you share any of the feedback that you've been able to hear?
Yeah, the feedback has been amazing. I get participants to post their pictures up on my Facebook page. So I have a City Indian Crafts page on Facebook. Yes, the feedback has been great. I've had multiple, you know, return participants come and make their own pair. They make a pair for somebody else or their kids, right? Or make it as a gift. So it's been nice to see some of the same people come back.
And then just lastly, before we get you out of here, I was wondering if you could maybe share what your favorite thing about hosting these workshops is.
I want to be able to teach people how to make it so we can carry it on. They can, you know, maybe teach their kids and their grandkids how to do it so we don't lose it. And like there's been so many people that walk away from the workshop, you know, thanking me, but I feel like it's effortless to, you know, to come out and teach people how to do this because the response has been amazing for, especially from our community. There's so many people in this community that have come out and done moccasins.
That's awesome. And I want to thank you again for doing this, Janine. I think these workshops are an awesome way to get involved within the community and then being able to gain some knowledge about some traditional indigenous cultural aspects as well. So best of luck with all the future workshops and hopefully they're very successful.
Thank you so much, Andy.
And this concludes this edition of Viewpoints. Our reporters this week were Ed Alverson, Erica Butler, Andrew Dow, and David Gordon Kosh. National editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Remember to follow all our stories on canada-info.ca. More than 50 journalists from all across the country are putting out multiple stories every week. Check them out. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, broadcast on your local radio station, and online at canada-info.ca. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. It was great to have you with us. Until next week, ciao.